on my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Next to him is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. Now that the introductions have been made, I will call the next case. This is our second case this morning in the March calendar. 97-2702 CR, State v. Foucher. Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin, will argue first. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the state in this court on appeal. This case, I think, is primarily here as a matter of timing. The Court of Appeals issued a decision which it recommended for publication and was ultimately published, in which it held that a juror was disqualified because that juror had formed what the Court of Appeals viewed as a strong opinion about the credibility of the state's main witness. In the course of that decision, the Court of Appeals observed that no court in Wisconsin had defined manifest bias, which was the primary tool for determining whether or not the juror was disqualified as not being indifferent or impartial. 2 days after that decision was issued, this court issued its decision in State versus Farron, where the state, or the court for the first time, did define manifest bias and defined it as a two-part test. The first part was whether or not the record supported or did not support a finding that the prospective juror is a reasonable person who is sincerely willing to put aside any prior knowledge or opinion. And the second prong was whether or not the record supported a finding that a reasonable person in the juror's position could set aside that opinion or prior knowledge. When that decision was brought to the Court of Appeals' attention, it issued an errata in which it added a footnote to its original opinion, footnote 6, and recognizing the Farron test, it first acknowledged that it agreed with the trial court that the juror in this question was a reasonable juror who was sincerely willing to put aside the preconceived opinion, but nonetheless remained convinced that that juror couldn't do it, to paraphrase the second part of the test. The main problem, it seems to me, that the bench and bar was left with after that was there was really no analysis or reasoning in the Court of Appeals opinion as to how the second prong of the Farron test applied, either as a matter generally or in this particular situation. To compound the matters, the Court of Appeals reasoning had relied on a State versus Gesch, which was an opinion of this court in which the court used an implied biased determination.
I want to make sure I'm following you. You, excuse me. As I take it, you read the Court of Appeals decision as determining that in this case there was an implied bias, that an actual bias did not in fact exist, but an implied bias did.
That's the way I read the opinion. Mm-hmm. There are a number of my colleagues read it less strongly to that extent. I think one of the problems with the opinion is that it's not totally clear whether the Court of Appeals is deciding the case on an implied bias situation, which is as I believe, entirely different than a Ferentz situation of actual bias, or whether it's deciding it under the second prong of Ferentz, which is an actual bias. Historically, implied bias has not gone to the particular impartiality of a given juror. It's been determined based on whether or not the juror fits into a particular category that either the legislature or the policy-making court of that jurisdiction has determined shouldn't serve for a general reason.
Now, your concern here, as expressed in your brief, is that, first of all, you don't think it's implied because those, as you just said, are normally set out in a statutory manner, if you're related, et cetera, et cetera. And here, as I understand, you think that this, if it's a second prong, is actually an actual bias, because we have we have the Delgado case, which is inferred. That's not quite the situation here. Implied wouldn't be, and so this would be an actual bias under the manifest two-part test, which was in Fair. Is that a correct understanding of what you're at least indicating to this court? I'm referring particularly to your page 17 that you're saying that this court should hold, to the extent the court of appeals decision should be read to establish an implied bias, it is incorrect. This is a case of actual bias, and it should be analyzed under Ferentz two-part test.
So that's correct. That's our position. I guess that my only hesitation there was the reference to Delgado, because as I see Delgado, which was a situation in which the juror incorrectly or dishonestly answered questions on voir dire, there are a number of factors in that case that just don't fit here. So I'm not exactly sure how that case fits with this one, but I think it's fair to say that our view, the state's view in this case, is that there's an implied bias, which is this general group disqualification, and that if one is inquiring into whether a particular juror is disqualified in a particular case, that's actual bias, which should be analyzed under Ferentz.
Okay, now let's look at Ferentz. I'm looking at footnote 6. I'm sorry, Fauscher.
Yep.
Footnote 6. This is the footnote that was added, right?
Right.
It says, 2 days after he released, they set forth a disjunctive test, and then they quote it. And then they say, this is the Court of Appeals in this case, we are satisfied that after applying the two-factor test announced in Ferentz, neither the reasoning we employed nor the result we reached changes in any way. As we implied in the body of our opinion, the juror in this case was a reasonable person who said he was sincerely willing to put aside an opinion or prior knowledge of the state's key witness. Thus, the first prong of the Ferentz test augurs in favor of the state. You agree with that?
I agree.
And that would be whether this particular juror had a bias.
Well, yes.
That a juror, who's reasonable, I mean, is sincerely willing to set aside a prior opinion, right?
Right.
That's the test.
Says they will, and the trial court believes they will try.
Right. So.
Right.
Would you say then he's not actually biased?
No.
You would.
No.
Right.
Because as I read the second prong.
Okay. That's to the first prong.
But the first prong, in my view, is not the only test of
action. That's right. I agree with that. Would you classify that as a subjective kind of test? It's a subjective kind of test.
Yes.
As to this particular juror, assuming, you know, he's a reasonable person, he can do it. We accept that. Okay.
Right. And also explicit from the testimony on the record.
Right. So that's as to him or her. Okay. Now, so when you pass, the state wins on the first test, but we're not done. The second test. But as to the second factor, wrote the Court of Appeals, we remain convinced that the record would not support a finding that a reasonable person in the juror's position could actually set aside his opinion as to the witness's credibility. So this juror, we believe, he said it, he was going to do it. Then you go to look at a reasonable juror in the abstract, right?
The term abstract concern.
Okay, a reasonable juror.
Yes.
Which is...
In this juror's position.
In this juror's position. So as to what... If that's always a reasonable person under the circumstances of that case. I mean, that's the reasonable person. But we won't debate that. Could actually set aside. And that's the Ferrand test. And then they say no.
Right.
Okay. Would you say that's an objective test?
Yes.
Okay. So Ferrand sets forth... Enough. Subjective test. Do you believe this juror did set aside whatever it was that created a bias?
I was willing to try.
Right. I was willing to try. Subjective answer, yes. That's for the state. Now you go to the objective. Could the reasonable person who had this kind of knowledge, could that person set it aside? And then the court says as a matter of law, no.
Right.
So that's
what the Court of Appeals said.
That's what the Court of Appeals said. Do you agree that that's the test under Ferrand?
I agree that's the test that should be applied, yes.
Right. And so you're not objecting to the first part where they find subjectively this juror could set it aside.
That's right.
You agree with that. So you disagree with the proposition of the Court of Appeals here that as a matter of law, a reasonable juror in the juror's position, in this juror's position, could not set it aside. That's what you object to.
What I object to is when I read the opinion, I can't tell what it is about this particular juror that disqualified.
Okay, but they saw something.
Yes.
And in applying that test.
Yes.
And you're just saying then that their application of this test is erroneous because you can't find anything in the record.
Well, yes, but I think the evil or the difficulty that creates is that because the Court of Appeals painted with a rather broad brush, what we have is a large group of prospective jurors who are going to be disqualified under the Fauscher
Tell me what the large group is. The way I see the group, it's a juror who knows a witness for a long period of time. 4 years, let's say 4 years, and on the basis of that juror's knowledge, that juror believes that this witness has integrity and would not lie, and the case involves the credibility of this witness, key witness.
If I could be totally assured that in the future the Court of Appeals would use that and only that criteria, I would be less concerned about this case.
Okay, where do they go broader than the criteria I set forth, namely the juror knows the witness for a substantial, you can use whatever word you like, period of time, and has confidence in the integrity and honesty of that witness. What's broader?
Well, what's broader is that it doesn't appear that the acquaintance in and of itself is sufficient, and there's case law both from the Court of Appeals and this court that is in fact correct. Because, and again in part because of timing, we don't have a record developed on why it is that this particular juror believed that this person wouldn't lie. And I'm not sure how that differs from case law that says a general opinion that a certain type or group of people, for instance, police officers, are more likely to tell the truth than drug dealers, which has been held repeatedly in a number of jurisdictions to not disqualify witnesses, is different than this juror's expression as to this particular witness. Now, if the Court of Appeals had said it's because from the language of the voir dire here, we're convinced that this opinion was so strongly held that it wouldn't be shaken, or that it was expressed after the juror had heard the testimony of the witness, then perhaps that would certainly, although I'd say not perhaps, that would certainly ease my concern about this case.
Let me follow up on that. On page 698, the court says that the juror not only knew Hayes, but based on his observations, believed her to be a person of integrity and wouldn't lie. Thus, the juror's own statements manifest bias. His credibility assessment has been preordained as a result of the out-of-court relationship, thereby raising serious doubt. The court goes on to say, and similar to Gesch, given the strength of the juror's opinion about the credibility, it is impossible for any court to determine with confidence that it would not be swayed. What more do you want?
Well, when I read the record, I say, why is it that the Court of Appeals reaches the conclusion that the credibility assessment was preordained or that it was so strongly held when the juror, when questioned, said, she was the next door neighbor, I knew the family very well, relatively so. I knew of her, and then says the statement, I not only knew of her, but I knew she was a girl of integrity. Now, it seems to me one can read that statement several different ways, anywhere from, this is a person who was acquainted with his next door neighbor, knew the child, had seen the child around for 4 to 5 years, had no reason to think that this was someone who would lie, all the way to the other end, where, as the Court of Appeals reads it, that this is a firmly held belief of the truthfulness or the credibility of this particular witness. And I don't know why it is that the Court of Appeals comes down on one side rather than the other. And I think that would be of great assistance to trial courts and advocates in the future.
Counsel, when I read the transcript, it seems to me that the Court of Appeals and your concern, this seems to be an unusual case in the sense that, just to go over this was a trial that was on its way. All of a sudden, Mr. Kaiser recognized the juror because she had apparently changed her name, and when the list was read, he was not aware of it. When they went in the voir dire, as you indicate, there are at least three times when we were talking about the credibility, etc. It seems to me, at least, and I'll just be, it's on 101, 102, and 103. 101 makes the statement, I know her, and not only knew of her, but she was a girl of integrity. 102 says, this is an answer, I know she's a person of integrity, and I know she wouldn't lie. And then, I guess to go to 103, there's a question. Mr. Kaiser, you indicated that you don't believe that Paulette would lie about anything. Is that correct? And the juror says, that's correct. And when you put that in the context that this is the only witness that saw the touching, the others didn't. I think the Court of Appeals, at least from what I can see, has made at least the decision. It's clear, and this is an exceptional situation where the ordinary next-door neighbor, people you don't get into, this is a very, I think, searching for Dyer about what he thought about her. And so your concern is that they didn't spell it out, and then we'll be getting a whole new class of people that you can't have your next door neighbor on the jury. Now, I think the question and the answers seem to be different, unless I'm reading, unless you think I'm putting a spin on that you don't see.
No, I don't, but I guess I feel that the major problem here was that the Court of Appeals didn't withdraw its prior opinion and write an opinion clearly under prayer in which it said what you just said. And had it done that, I think perhaps not only could it clear up some questions that perhaps were unanswered in Farron because this court decided Farron under the first prong, but could have made clear that when a court decides one of these cases under the first prong of Farron.
First prong being actual.
I'm sorry. Under the second prong, under the reason, whether or not the reasonable juror could set this aside.
That's the objective.
The objective test,
or
right?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure we're on the same track with language, because terminology is important. First prong is actual bias, and that's the subjective test. Second prong, correct me if I'm wrong, is inferred bias, and that's the objective test. Are we?
Yes, although I'm not sure everyone totally agrees on what to call that second prong.
Right,
it is an objective test, and it is actual bias, at least in my view.
The second prong is actual bias?
Actual bias, but it's actual bias that is inferred from the record.
Oh,
it's not explicit in the record.
Okay.
And that's part of the problem with this whole area, is that the terminology has been rather loosely used, and so one court uses one term, and it means something different than one of the other cases said, and yet people are trying to use the same principles, and we fall apart there.
Could I ask you, you seem to want to distinguish the Delgado case in some earlier comments, but you just used the term inferred with respect to the second prong.
Yes.
Ought we look to Delgado for any guidance on this or not?
I'd say not. The terminology might be helpful, but once you get past terminology, Delgado focuses on things that simply aren't present in this case. So I'm not sure how helpful it is. Okay. Terminology is definitely a problem in this area. And anything this court could do to clear it up would be helpful. However, given all of the different views I've heard over the past month, I'm not sure that that's possible. But in any event, it seems to me that the second prong of the Farron test, the objective test, the big problem, well, there are several problems with it, one of which is that if the court doesn't carefully articulate what facts disqualify a given witness and what facts about both the juror, him or herself, and the case disqualify that witness, that tends to disqualify all other jurors that meet those criteria. So the broader that is articulated, the more people get disqualified in the future, which I think this court has said in the past is not good public policy.
Counsel, I get back to the Chief's question. What is this broad category that you're so concerned about here? I mean, here we've got the facts of somebody's neighbor who he believes is a very truthful person and would not lie. I don't have a whole lot of problem with saying jurors like that should probably not sit on a jury in a he says, she says case.
But I probably don't either, but we do have some cases where acquaintance in situations where one would think that, although perhaps not articulated, that juror would have a preconceived notion about credibility of a witness would exist, and we've said that doesn't disqualify the juror. So I guess it's important to me, maybe I'm just dense, but it's important to me that the courts say it's not only the acquaintance, it's not only the fact that this juror has a preconceived notion of credibility. It's a confluence of those two things and the fact that this particular witness was the only witness who had direct evidence of the crime that makes it important in this case that this juror not sit. So that in the next case where someone has a preconceived notion that's not so strongly held, or the witness is a chain of custody witness, that we don't say this person is disqualified because the chain of custody witness is their next door neighbor.
But with all due respect, that's exactly what the court said at 698. One, how he knew her. two, that he thought she was a person of integrity who wouldn't lie. Three, that the trial was a credibility contest between Hayes and Foucher, the sole witness and the alleged perpetrator of the crime. Those are the exact factors that the Court of Appeals laid out. And you are asking that this court set forth those factors and then apply it to these facts. Is that
well, right? Except that those factors are all stated in an implied bias, with an implied bias background before Farron came down.
They repeat that. They say that there's no change in their opinion.
Right. Does that mean
note
that...
Note 6.
But to me, that's... Are they doing an implied bias analysis?
So if they did it under Farron, you would say that was okay?
I would be much more comfortable with
that,
yes.
Much more comfortable. Okay. I have another question for you. In Delgado, this was treated as a Weiss case, and then we had other cases that came up on the jurors, and they were all treated somewhat separately in various categories. Now we have Foucher, and it is a separate category using the Farron line. Now, I went back and looked at Delgado and the Weiss opinion, and in Weiss, the standard for awarding a new trial, the second prong there is, quote, that it is more probable than not that under the facts and circumstances surrounding the particular case, the juror was biased against the moving party. That's
right.
A quote from Weiss, quoted in Delgado.
Right.
And the second Farron test is that the record does not support a finding that the reasonable person could set aside it. And that it's more probable than not. That is the same test in Farron. That it is more probable than not, under the facts and circumstances, that the juror was biased.
If you look at solely the statement of the test itself, mm-hmm. That's correct.
That's correct. So
But when you look at Delgado or Weiss's factors for determining that,
sure.
Then we get into something that's so totally foreign from this case.
That's right, but the test is the same.
That's right, and if one would say that the second prong of Farron is inferring actual bias from the record because we don't think the juror can do what they
right.
say they do.
And isn't that what the test is?
It seems to me that, in my mind, that conceptually makes sense. I won't purport to speak for everyone who reads those cases, but in my mind, that makes sense.
That makes sense, and that's the test that's set forth in Delgado.
That's right.
Okay.
I was going to say that this case came up, and it is similar to the Chief's question in Delgado. Only here we have a juror who did not answer correctly. And I haven't read the whole record, but obviously this juror was read a list of witnesses as, you know, do you recognize any of these names? And obviously, he didn't recognize, and he's... So that it goes, gets into the state's case, which is almost over, and all of a sudden he realizes that, I knew somebody here. Now, if he had not recognized that person and he had used his knowledge going into the jury room, we might have a similar case to Delgado where a person was asked the question, answered it, or didn't answer it, and then revealed the information in the jury room. So I guess it's another reason why I think this is kind of a, quote, unique fact situation because the person did not recognize the name, did not answer, and so he was duty-bound to say, I knew this person when he, because of a name variance or whatever, recognized her. So it does throw it in a little different category, which I think allows us to make a difference with this case. Now
I agree with that. In this case, there's no question that the juror honestly answered all of the voir dire questions. And there's also no question that as soon as he realized that the witness who was identified as, I can't remember which name is which, but Ms. Hayes, was in fact someone he knew, he informed the bailiff who brought it to the circuit court's attention and voir dire that forms the bulk of the record in this case was created. So the juror immediately came forward and revealed the problem, and the trial court dealt with it as best it could at that point. So I agree with that those, and that is one of the reasons that in looking at these cases, I didn't particularly rely on the Weiss case, because the factors are so different.
Well, thank you, Mr. Weinstein. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hagopian, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, Boucher.
May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Hagopian, and I represent the defendant, appellant George Fauché. The Court of Appeals was right. Juror Kaiser's bias was manifest. It was manifest in his opinion that the state's key witness would not lie. And that opinion was not based on anything that the juror had heard in court. Rather, it was based on his 4-year relationship with the witness, Paulette Hayes. This case was a credibility contest between two people, George Fauché and Paulette Hayes. Now, Juror Kaiser told the court, and these were his words, he knew that Paulette Hayes was a girl of integrity, and he knew she would not lie. A reasonable person in Juror Kaiser's position could not set aside that opinion, not when called upon to determine who was telling the truth, George Fauché or Paulette Hayes.
How does that differ from what happens so often and also reflected in our case law, law enforcement officers? I've got a nice, well-appearing law enforcement officer, grew up in Wausau, good family, and he's testifying against some guy who looks like a scuzz and testifies he had six prior criminal convictions. Maybe I bring to that a prejudice that this law enforcement officer is going to be credible. Maybe the jury even says, when asked on voir dire, do you think this law enforcement officer is going to be more truthful than this guy who looks like a scuzz and 6 prior convictions? That's not a problem, is it? And don't we have that all the time? Isn't the real question not whether they're prejudiced, because we're all prejudiced, you know, we like the Elks, so we don't like the Elks Club members, we like out-of-town lawyers, or we like big-town lawyers, we're all prejudiced. The question is whether or not we can set aside that prejudice. Do you agree with that?
I agree.
What in the record, then, shows a court of appeals analysis that this juror so strongly held a prejudice that it could not be set aside?
Well, I think the first thing is the manner in which his opinion was disclosed to the court, in that in the voir dire examination, when the court began with rather open-ended questions, starting with, first of all, what is the nature of your relationship? He described that this had been a neighbor for 4 years, and then he ended that description by saying, and I know she's a girl of integrity. The court asked another somewhat open-ended question, which is, could you judge her testimony the same as any other witness? And the juror's response is, I know she's a person of integrity. I know she would not lie. I think those are very revealing statements, because it shows that this is in the forefront of his mind. It shows that this is a set opinion. And then he's asked, again, by defense counsel, do you believe that she is a person who would not lie about anything? That's right. What is that based on? It's based on my relationship with her, my knowledge of her as my neighbor. So I think that in analyzing this, what the Court of Appeals was looking at was both the nature and the strength of the opinion. And the nature of the opinion going to, does it relate to a matter that's important to this case? And the Court of Appeals said, well, yeah, it sure does, because they're talking about the credibility of the state's key witness in a case which Justice Babich described as a he said, she said. So it's critical. Then, the strength of the opinion. Why is this such a strongly held opinion? Because it's not based on some general impression. I think what you had described as would fit more in that category, where a person has an impression that the respectable-looking police officer is going to tell the truth and the scuzzy defendant is not. Those are general impressions.
So your answer is the nature of the opinion and the strength of the opinion are the two prongs that should be reflected in the record in order to say that this record is strong enough.
Yes.
Okay. Now, isn't the strength of the opinion really a credibility determination, though it kind of blends in with number one? I mean, why is the Court of Appeals stronger to in a better position to assess the strength of the opinion than the trial court, who's there, listens, sees, watches the facial expressions, hears the way that's articulated? Why do we give the trial court, in your response, less accord than the Court of Appeals with regard to assessing the strength of the opinion?
Well, I guess to first of all be clear that we're not questioning the juror's sincere willingness to try to set it aside. But the question then under the second prong of Farron is whether a reasonable person in that position could do that, and that is an objective test based on the totality of the record. It's also a question that, in this case, the trial court never reached.
Then I'm not following. What did you mean by the strength of the opinion?
By the strength of the opinion, I mean essentially what is that opinion based on?
And it's based here on that they're a neighbor, that he said, let me get the exact language. There's exact language several places, but the court says, and tell me in general the nature of the acquaintanceship, Juror Hayes. Well, our next door neighbor, and I knew the family very well, relatively, so I knew who she, I knew of her, not only knew of her, and she was a girl of integrity.
Listen. Yes, and then he elaborated somewhat by saying that she's always over there visiting and stuff. We always go by and say hi and that kind of stuff. So clearly, his opinion about her credibility was not based on some general impression, not based on something he'd heard, not based on a news account, based on his firsthand personal experience. And I think that kind of opinion or prior knowledge is going to be much more difficult for the juror to set aside. A reasonable person in that juror's position is going to have a much harder time setting aside something, a conclusion that they've reached based on their own personal experience, than on something they just heard. And this court has drawn this distinction in a recent case, State versus Broomfield, where there the juror had overheard some other people who had sat on another case that may have resulted in a hung jury, and they heard some disparaging things about the defendant. And the court made the comment that overhearing that kind of information, essentially gossip, doesn't concern us so much. And why not? Because the person's not going to view that as very reliable information. And we can anticipate that the juror is going to be able to set that information aside. And the court contrasted that sort of overheard gossip information with news accounts that would be more difficult for an individual to set aside because it has an air of reliability. But we are beyond news accounts in this case. I would say we are really at the polar extreme, which is an opinion, prior knowledge based on an individual's firsthand experience. And, you know, this concept may really be coming to the forefront because of the second prong in Farron, but really these notions have been addressed by the courts for years. And in fact, Chief Justice Marshall in 1807 noted this distinction between what he described as light impressions that we can fairly expect would yield to the presentation of testimony. Those we're not too concerned about. General impressions, our own general prejudice, the bias that we all carry. But when we're talking about a conclusion and a opinion that we've reached based on our own personal experience, that is a concern. And that's why I think really this isn't a close case. The bias was manifest, and the Court of Appeals was right to overrule the trial court's decision.
Manifest in that it's actual bias that is inferred. I take it that's your position.
Yes, I would agree.
And our review is a de novo review of that.
I would agree.
I'm asking if that is your
position. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's wrong with the state's position? At least as far as I think I understand the state's position, they're saying that this is really an actual bias case and that we should review it under the first prong.
Well, actually, as I understand their position, it's that this is an actual bias case, although I believe Mr. Weinstein agrees that it's actual bias inferred from the record, but that his complaint is that the Court of Appeals, by referencing Gesch, has created confusion that some may interpret this as creating an implied bias, and I don't see that confusion at all. You know, an implied bias is referring to the disqualification of groups of persons based on their status. That's not what we have here. This juror is disqualified not because he's acquainted, not because of the fact of him being a neighbor. It's more than that. And it is really the whole totality of the circumstances which the Chief Justice had listed.
Should it make a difference if the witness is not this critical of a witness? And here we've got the he said, she said. And the Court of Appeals obviously put some significance on that. What if it is a, you know, something less? And where do we draw the line? Or don't we have to in this case?
We certainly do not have to in this case. And, you know, I think that's an important point, though, that every fact counts. Every nuance could make a difference. I view this case really as at the extreme. And though the Court of Appeals decision provides guidance for lower courts, as, for example, with decisions in a Fourth Amendment area on interpreting what's reasonable suspicion for a stop, provides guidance, but it doesn't result in automatic results in other cases. It's not automatic disqualification of any other jurors because they're not going to fit exactly within the shoes of Juror Kaiser.
Could I ask you to respond to the relationship between Delgado and the second prong of Farron?
I agree really how the Chief Justice has described that these are consistent standards when looking at, in determining whether there is bias on this record, whether you are inferring it. But I would also agree with Mr. Weinstein that then the analogy kind of stops because Delgado is dealing with a situation where the juror did not truthfully or completely answer questions on voir dire, and then disclose the information that should have been disclosed on voir dire in the deliberations. And that's how it then came to light. Whereas here we have a juror who had, for example, had the state had its witnesses present in court during voir dire, I imagine this all would have been addressed at the beginning of trial. And we wouldn't have been in the same situation. But Delgado goes on to list the factors that you need to consider in deciding whether that test in Delgado has been met. And those factors really are not applicable because we're not dealing with a juror who withheld information.
Do you think the test is that it's more probable than not under the facts and circumstances that the juror was biased against the defendant, that you infer bias? Is that the test in Farron?
Well, I don't recall Farron using that exact language. The language used is whether a reasonable person in that juror's position could set it aside. But I see some similarity between the two tests.
Could I change the facts of the case a little bit? Suppose the juror lived across the street from Ms. Hayes, and suppose in the voir dire colloquy, Ms. Hayes, or the juror had simply said she was a girl of integrity twice, but had never said, I know she wouldn't lie. That make any difference?
I don't think that is really a very significant change in the facts. Living across the street and being a neighbor, pretty similar in that it appears, assuming the facts are the same, that he had based that opinion on his personal relationship with that woman.
Well, suppose I had, I have three neighbors, one on either side, one across the street. They seem like they're very nice people. We don't socialize. We say hi. One of them is a witness. I'm asked about it, and I say just what I just said, and I might say I have no reason to believe that they're not credible. I have no reason to believe they are credible, but I do know them.
But that would not be manifest bias.
That would not be manifest bias. So I have to go further than just knowing them.
Yes.
You have to say that they're a person of integrity. You said that was manifest bias, right? Facts being the same, just take off the and would not lie part.
Well, I mean, to say that a person of integrity is pretty close to saying I believe they're truthful.
How about she's a nice young woman?
Well, that's less problematic, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that manifest bias? Everything else being the same, except the statement. She's a nice young woman.
That probably is not.
How about her family is a fine family, upstanding citizens, and I believe her to be so also? What about that? Is that manifest bias?
That may not be either. You know, it really is.
So I believe that she is a fine and an upstanding citizen is not manifest bias.
Well, it may not be. I mean, it would be helpful after a question like that to have additional questioning of that juror to find out what else they may share with the court.
Well, wouldn't it have been helpful in this record, too? We have the conclusions here of integrity and would not lie, and a fact, apparently, that when they go by, or they're visiting, and we go by and say hi, and that kind of stuff. I mean, see, my concern is what in the record makes the Court of Appeals say, hey, she couldn't, or the juror couldn't set aside the bias. What in the record is it here? Because we'll talk about how we're going to define this for future cases and for future litigants. And I'm having a real problem with that. What in the record makes the Court of Appeals feel so strongly that even though it was said several times by this juror, I can set it aside, I can set it aside, I can set it aside, and the trial court made a finding of fact, they could set to prejudice or bias aside. What is it in this record that makes that finding so wrong?
Well, I think it is, first, that the opinion expressed went to the very heart of what any person sitting on that jury was going to have to decide.
Well, how about my fact situation? As Justice Crosser said, same facts, except her family is a fine family, upstanding citizens, and I believe her to be so also.
Well, from that one might infer that the juror believed that witness would not lie, but you have to draw that inference. Here, we don't have to infer anything. The opinion was that she would not lie about anything. So it's so much more direct, and it goes right to the heart of it.
So it's that phrase, she would not lie. And where do you get the variations? You know, where do you draw the line then? Or is there no guidance for the future? It depends on if this court says, that seems pretty strong. She would not lie. She's a person of integrity. She's a fine and upstanding citizen. I don't know about her. I know her family is a fine, upstanding citizens, and I assume that she is too. Where do you draw the line? What in the record helps us draw that line?
Well, I think it is the totality of the record with great emphasis on the precise opinion that was expressed and the way that he expressed it, in that when he is asked an open-ended question of, you know, describe your relationship, he could have said any, you know, all sorts of things and not said anything about her credibility, but that's what he says. And then when he's asked, could he judge her testimony the same as any other witness, where if he felt confident he could do that, one would expect him to say yes or maybe or I'll try. But he doesn't say that. He says, I know she's a person of integrity. I know she won't lie. I mean, I think that shouts at us what was going on with this juror. And again, it's a reasonable person in that position. But I think that's very significant. And you know, no one has questioned this juror's sincerity. And when you're talking about most of the people called to jury service, good citizens trying to do their job, we have to be careful as the questions become more leading, as it becomes clearer what the answer should be, that the conscientious citizen is going to feel some pressure to say, yeah, I can do it, because he's been asked, if I instruct you to set that aside, can you do that? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court had commented that a question like that is often the father of the answer, yes, I can be impartial.
Now, we've talked about the standard. But in this case, your client agreed to go ahead with a jury of 11, didn't it?
Yes, he did.
And the state, and it had misgivings, also agreed to go ahead with a jury of 11. So why isn't all of this waived?
Well, because he only agreed to do that after his two requests for a mistrial had been denied. So that
he could, you're presenting this case as if he in effect said, stay on with the 12, and I'm going to demand that the conviction be overturned because I had a partial juror. One juror that's not impartial is enough to kick it over. I mean, that's how you're presenting this case, yet that isn't the case at all. He had a choice. He could have stayed put and rolled the dice on it. And what he did is he knocked off the juror, agreed to go with 11. And now he's complaining where there's a conviction of 11 impartial jurors.
That was not a voluntary waiver of his right to a 12-person jury. And he had a right to both an impartial jury and to a jury of 12. And it was only when he was not going to be able to have an impartial jury of 12 that he then agreed to go ahead with 11 jurors.
Did his lawyer move for mistrial?
Twice.
Yeah, but you're saying that, in other words, he eventually agreed. He was coerced into that? He could. Is there in the record, and I have not read that, where he said that we will not go on, no, we refuse to go ahead with the trial?
His lawyer twice moved to have the juror removed and then for a mistrial because there were no alternates. When those requests were denied, then the lawyer said, well, as a lesser solution, my client will agree to proceed with 11. But it was...
Knowing full well if he was found not guilty, then he'd be off, so this gives him the second kick at the cat.
Well, but he hasn't had the trial that he's guaranteed by the Constitution. He hasn't had his trial of 12 by an impartial jury. I mean, he was forced to give up one right to keep the other. His decision to go with 11 was not voluntary, and to be a valid waiver of a 12-person jury, it has to be made personally by the defendant and voluntarily, and that did not occur in this case.
Sounds like Shades of Ramos.
Well, yeah, I mean, the principle's the same, except I think here we're talking about an even more important principle, in that Ramos is the right to peremptory challenges, a statutory right, and here is the constitutional right.
But in Ramos like this, there was no argument that the jury was unfair. But the 11 jurors here, there's no argument that they're less than impartial. And there's no argument in Ramos that the impaneled jury was anything other than an impartial and fair jury.
That's correct. That's correct. I would just like to make one more comment and then conclude. Justice Wilcox made the comment that this is an unusual case, and I think it is an unusual case from a number of perspectives. One, I believe, that makes it unusual is that it's really a convergence of two sort of circumstances in the case law. In one fact pattern, we have cases where a juror is acquainted with a participant in the trial, but there's no expression of opinion. And frankly, most of those cases, there's also no manifest bias. And then we have another line of cases where the juror has formed some sort of opinion relevant to the case, but has no relationship, no personal relationship with anyone involved in the case. This case is a convergence of those two. We have a juror who had formed an opinion that was critical to the case, and that opinion was based on his relationship with that witness. And that's why I would submit this isn't a close case. It's at the extreme. I would also say that the Court of Appeals has not created confusion here, that although it issued this decision 2 days before Farron was decided, the court was really rather prescient in its decision, and that it reached the right result, applied essentially the right reasoning, and we would ask that this court affirm so that Mr. Fauché would be entitled to a new trial at which he would have both his right to an impartial jury and a jury of 12. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein. And would you address, please, the waiver issue? The state, too, waived.
I'm sorry?
Would you address the potential waiver issue? The state, too, agreed to 11 persons.
Certainly. I tend to agree with Ms. Hagopian that the fact that he advanced his motions for mistrial based on the trial court's denial of his challenge put him in a position where only the waiver is only voluntary if the trial court was correct in denying the challenge. I think once if one concedes that the trial court was incorrect, then I think she makes a very good point that he had either to forego the jury of 12 or forego the impartiality, because if we find the juror, the trial court was incorrect, the juror was not impartial. In terms of the overall case, Ms. Hagopian a number of times noted that we should decide these cases on the totality of the circumstances of the case, and I find that interesting because I agree with that, but I don't really find that specifically set out in Farron. The two articulations of the test, one of the, does the record support a finding a reasonable person in the juror's position could set aside the opinion, and the explanation of the second prong where this court says the appellate court can determine whether under the particular circumstances surrounding the voir dire examination, no reasonable juror could put aside the bias or opinion, doesn't really say we look at whether this is an important witness and exactly how it comes up in the trial. Now, when I read the case in its entirety, I come to that conclusion, but I guess I would be a little more comfortable overall in this area if the trial court, if this court said you are to consider the totality of the circumstances, the juror's circumstances, the witness's circumstances, the circumstances of how this case comes up. And I think that is important because there is a concern, I believe, under the second prong of Farron, where when a witness is disqualified under that prong, if the court doesn't clearly articulate and narrowly draw the facts which lead it to believe that no reasonable person could set aside this opinion, we in effect are disqualifying a group of people, that is, anyone who meets those facts. The less facts articulated and the broader they're articulated, the more people are comprehended in that group. So to that extent, I would disagree with Ms. Hagopian that this case doesn't involve the disqualification of groups of jurors. I think it does. And that's really true of search and seizure also. It's just over the years in the development of search and seizure, we have gotten everyone, appellate courts, trial courts, and advocates, all on the same page that we look at each case individually. That's not clear in this area yet. And I think this court needs to say that's the way we need to approach this.
Since you agree with the public defender that the waiver was not voluntary, isn't the defendant entitled to a new trial?
I think, and certainly...